This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because our microphones make a virtual Main Street all across the state this time of day. Those real Main Streets that are the centerpieces of our communities are where we meet and greet our friends and neighbors and talk about what's on our minds. And occasionally in North Dakota, we talk about the Bakken because it's such an important economic driver for our state. And today we're going to talk with Deb Nelson. She is the founder of DLN Consulting in Dickinson, and she's been working with Vision West ND to come up with some projections about economic development that might be useful to the counties affected in the oil patch. Deb, thank you for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here, Doug. Thanks.
Let's start with some basic descriptions here. What is Vision West ND?
Vision West North Dakota, Vision West ND is a consortium of representatives, interested people from colleges, counties, cities, economic development organizations, industry, and a number of organizations in the 19 Western energy-producing counties, so the oil, gas, and coal-producing counties.
And what do you do for Vision West North Dakota?
As administrator, I'm responsible for the day-to-day operations and to keep the consortium organized and to administer their meetings and administer their funding. So it's basically anything that an administrator or an executive director might do for an organization.
And how is Vision West ND funded?
Vision West ND is funded primarily from membership dues. We did have, what started us was a large Housing and Urban Development grant that ended in January of 2015. And by all rights, the consortium might have ended their work that they were doing. Their job at that time was to develop a regional plan for sustainability across the 19 counties. But they said, you know what, we just have a plan. We have to start working on implementation. And so we started with membership dues, and then we also are grant-funded. We have several different grants that we have been awarded that's been very helpful for us.
Well, give us the broad outline of the study that you conducted first in 2012 and then just recently updated.
Okay. We've been very fortunate to have a relationship with Agribusiness and Applied Economics at NDSU. In 2012, they did a study for us, and it involved each of the 19 counties received their own information, as well as a regional report that outlined the housing needs, population projections, and workforce projections at that time in 2012 when we were at the height of the oil boom. And this was specifically done for planning to give the counties and the cities in our region some hard, good numbers that they could look at to work on planning. That study was based on when we were at the height of the oil boom. That changed. So in 2016, we started looking at how has this changed and what are the needs as far as housing, as far as workforce, what kinds of workforce are we needing, what kinds of housing are we needing, and what might our population look like. It's a shorter time span that we're looking at, and again, it's just projections. But it's an interesting study because it's based on scenarios. It's based on if oil sells for this price, what are the needs? If it sells for a more moderate price, what are the needs? And if it goes back up to that high of $100 a barrel, what would be the needs? And so it's very interesting in that the counties and the cities are able to look at the different scenarios, see where we are at this point in time, and then take a look at what those projections might mean for them.
Well, before we dig into it, give us a kind of a snapshot. In 2012, as you mentioned, things were sort of at or approaching their peak. Now, 2017, we're recovering a bit. Oil is moving above $60 a barrel, but it's been well below it for a long time. So what's the difference between those two projections, 2012 and 2017?
In 2012, we were looking at housing needs that were that far outpaced the ability for the cities and counties to meet. We were looking at a different kind of workforce. We were looking primarily at a lot of single people, primarily men, who were coming from all over the country to work in the oil patch. Our wages increased dramatically to be able to meet the services that had to be put into place and meet the needs of the population at that time. That's changed now, of course, in that the housing is pretty much in place, and it's allowed our numbers as far as rentals are concerned, and also potentially the sale of housing to be able to come down to a much more manageable amount. It's also looking at a difference in the types of people that are being employed in the oil patch right now. And with that, what their housing needs are, there isn't such a need anymore for those man camps or crew camps that sprang up all over the place. And so there's some significant changes, yet we still have a lot of jobs available that it would be nice to be filled.
Well, we all remember back in 2012 when things were going kind of nuts. They couldn't build things fast enough, housing fast enough, that's for sure. So does the study indicate now that there's some places in the state that are overbuilt?
You know, it really doesn't. And in fact, in some counties, it's actually indicating that we could use some additional housing. What it does indicate is that we have a lot of housing. We don't necessarily have a lot of housing for the population that needs the housing. Mm. We have a lot of housing for those middle-class people and those mid-priced houses and apartments. But the population that is really looking to for housing right now, younger families, you know, they're looking they're looking at startup housing or needing housing, first-time home buyers, and there aren't a lot of those. Most of those houses are going to be in the, you know, in the upper mid to upper range prices, and so there's a change in the type of housing that's needed. Not necessarily that we have too much or that we overbuilt in housing. There may be some overbuilding in hotels, but we didn't get into that in the study.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton talking with Deb Nelson. She is with DLN Consulting in Dickinson and is administering the Vision West North Dakota updated study of the needs in the oil patch. Deb, specifically, how was the information gathered so that you could be consistent from study to study?
Well, a lot of the information, especially the housing information, was gathered at the same time that NDSU was doing the North Dakota statewide housing assessment. And so they were able to pull out a lot of the information for our area from that statewide assessment. So that was very helpful. I also know that Dr. Hoder and Dean Bangsund from NDSU, they interviewed a lot of the industry representatives to find out what kinds of people, who are you hiring, what are the needs for those jobs that are available. So they actually went around and did a lot of one-on-one interviews and talking with people to gather their information, as well as, of course, they sent out information or sent out surveys. And so we had gathered both qualitative and quantitative types of information to gather for the study. And they had developed a really complex methodology, and they utilized that through each of the counties that we have in our region.
Well, the most important element here is the price of oil, and you have three different scenarios that you do in the study. One is for a low price, 25 to 60 bucks a barrel, a moderate price up to 90, and then a high price over 90. And I think in your analysis, you purposely focus on the low projection, that the more conservative one. Is that correct?
We did. Of course, all of those scenarios are there, and so if those prices do go up significantly, those who reviewing the study will be able to look at those higher price. But we intentionally kept it low because it appeared, at least at the time that the study was put together, that we weren't going to have those high-priced barrels of oil much anymore. And, you know, shale production has been tempered down a little bit. We believe that it's going to stay in that lower range. And so even though right now oil is up over $60 a barrel, we're still really encouraging our cities and counties to look at that lower, under $60 a barrel price.
Well, I remember when we were all going, shucks, this is unbelievable, when oil was about $120 a barrel. And of course, it was a reminder of how volatile this commodity can be. So let's get as specific as you can about the projections that the study now indicates. What does the updated Vision West North Dakota study indicate about future employment and population and housing needs?
Housing needs, we know that if we have a whole bunch of single people coming in, they're not going to want to buy houses. They're not going to go into higher-end apartment buildings. They're still going to want those man camps. However, most of the time right now, we're looking at families. We know that the oil companies are wanting to hire people who will move into the area if they aren't here now and remain stable in the area. Therefore, there is a definite need for that single-family housing and housing that meets the needs of younger families. That's something that we're encouraging people to look at, taking a look at the age of their housing that they have. These young families are not interested in housing that's 60 or 80 or 100 years old. They don't want housing that they're going to have to do a lot of upkeep and or they're going to have to do a lot of remodeling. They want to move into something that is relatively new. So that's one thing that we're encouraging our communities to look at not necessarily building new housing, but perhaps rehabbing what they have. The other type of people that are really looking at moving or changing their housing needs are the senior citizen population. Mm. They're often selling their homes that they've been in for a long time, and they're looking at something that meets their needs at a perhaps lower income level or smaller footprint. As far as population are concerned, you know, we have not, our younger population is increasing. We don't have the numbers in the 45 to 85 age group that we did have. Instead, we're seeing trends of younger population. We know that our schools are continuously looking at expanding. Most of our larger communities are looking at building schools. So population means, with those families means that we also need to take a look at childcare. And so childcare facilities are going to be something that's going to be very important when we look at workforce in Western North Dakota. It's not that it isn't important now. It's extremely important, but it's going to just get increasingly more important as time goes on. And then, of course, the service industry, if we're going to have an increased population, we need to have the services that people want to have in the communities. And so those communities, and we're encouraging all of our communities and our counties to take a look at what they are providing as far as services are concerned and meet the needs of those younger families that are either moving in or are here as a result of the oil industry.
So the oil patch has created kind of a demographic shift. It's the senior citizens that were populating a lot of those communities in the western part of the state that were not flourishing necessarily have moved to other places. Younger people have moved in. The nature of the worker, it's not the boom worker anymore so much. It's a more of a stable growth. So are these opportunities for some of these really tiny towns out there in the patch to do some things to attract residents?
Absolutely. And that's something that we are constantly looking at Vision West North Dakota. The consortium is always looking at opportunities that might be helpful to the region, to our smaller towns. And so we're doing a lot of different kinds of projects as a result of what we've learned from this study to help our small and mid-sized communities with their economic sustainability over the long term, and providing them with resources and information, and helping them with planning, and that, you know, that sort of thing. So it's important. If they're going to stay vital, they're going to have to meet the needs of this population.
Does the study indicate anything about the potential for increases in wages?
It does not. One of the things, of course, that happened from 2010 through 2014 is the wages increased dramatically out
yes,
here.
Yes, yeah.
to the point where, you know, it drove some people out of business in some cases because they couldn't keep up with the need for wages. Wages have come down a bit to reflect, you know, the fact that we aren't at the height of the boom, but they have not come down to pre-boom levels. They're still relatively good wages out here. And so in McDonald's, you know, isn't hiring at $17 an hour anymore, but you can get a pretty good job now at, you know, $12, $12.50, $13 an hour, which is considerably higher than a lot of the other places in the mm-hmm. state for the same kind of jobs.
So there have been adjustments to the once sky-high cost of living in the Bakken, and that's reflected in how things are now, I take it.
It is, yes. So rents have come down, wages have come down. None of them have come down to pre-boom levels. We don't expect that they will. We think that they're still going to stay, you know, in a very marketable dollar amount.
What are the most important findings for the counties that need this information? We've been talking about lots of things here. What's the most important thing for them to take from this updated Vision West North Dakota study?
I think the most important thing that they could do overall, generally, is just to take a look at each county has its own report. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we haven't really brought out. But each county has its own set of data. So they can look at it regionally, but then they can look at their own individual county. And we have that on our visionwestnd.com website. And I think that's going to be very important for them to review, to be familiar with, because we believe very strongly that these numbers are going to be right on. And if the counties are interested in staying vital, being sustainable, that they look strongly at these numbers. Housing is always going to be at the top as far as needs are concerned. At one time, it was just numbers of housing. It didn't matter what it was. If there was housing, we needed it. Now it's what type of housing are people looking at that will bring them into their communities.
I can recall back in 2012 and subsequent legislative sessions, there was a sort of a fierce debate between the oil patch and the legislature about funding for necessary infrastructure growth and all kinds of stuff. So I'm assuming this information will be used in discussions with the legislature about the oil patch.
Yes. In fact, it's already being used in the interim committees. They have this information. They are looking at it when they're right now debating what they're going to do with the hub city funding and with the formula funding.
So it's important that this study be looked at is strictly objective, I assume, so that it's not looked like the 19 counties are leveraging information for a lobbying effort.
No, it isn't. It isn't for that. It's good information for them to have when they are talking with their legislators and looking at what their funding needs might be. On the other hand, this was a purely objective study that has a good, strong methodology that will withstand any scrutiny.
When will it be updated again?
We literally just got our hands on the printed version of this about a month ago, and we haven't really talked about when it'll be updated, but I can guess that if we see some significant changes out here again in our commodities and the prices of our commodities, then we're probably going to have to look at what does that mean for our counties and for their sustainability. When that happens, we'll probably have to study again.
All right. Deb Nelson is with DLN Consulting in Dickinson, the administrator of Vision West North Dakota, and we're talking about an updated study. Thank you, Deb, for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Coming up next on Main Street, Chuck Lura talks about some winter reading.
Support for this program is provided by Great River Energy and its 320 employees who are partnering with North Dakota to help our country meet its growing demands for energy while utilizing new technologies for a cleaner environment.
The 21st Annual Celebration of Women and Their Music will be held Saturday, January 20th at the stage at Island Park, featuring Brenda Wyler, Rosie Savageau-Nestingen, Laura Jossend, Emily Holt, Haley E. Rydell, and many more. Tickets available at 21stcelebrationofwomen.eventbrite.com. For complete information on all 3 days of events, go to debjenkins.com/celebrationofwomen.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. If you want to learn about the plant and animal life that surrounds us where we live, Chuck Lura's Natural North Dakota essays offer fascinating glimpses of the biological life that Chuck teaches his students about at Dakota College at Bottineau. Today, his Natural North Dakota essay offers an indoor activity for the season under the title Winter Reading.
It's often this time of year when the days are short and temperatures are often below zero that the outdoors is not as inviting as we'd prefer. That's when we often look to the bookshelf to help us out. I was thinking about all that recently and thought that you might appreciate some suggestions on some good books related to nature. So here are a few books I've enjoyed, in no particular order, but all of them are nature-related, most relevant to our region, and some are from a historical perspective. Perhaps the most widely read and highly regarded book on nature and a land ethic is Aldo Leopold's The Sand County Almanac from 1949. Leopold himself said it best, and I quote here, "There are some who can live without wild things and some who cannot. These essays are the delights and dilemmas of one who cannot," unquote. It's an easy read and a must-read for anyone interested in nature and natural resource management. Any book by Sigurd Olson is good. His books include Listening Point, Wilderness Days, The Singing Wilderness, and Reflections from the North Country. Sigurd Olson was extremely instrumental in getting the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness established. His book, Runes of the North, is about the haunting appeal of the wilderness and the tales and legends, reflections, and adventures set in the vast wilderness of the North that sweeps from the Quetico Superior in Hudson Bay to the Yukon in Alaska. Chapter titles include Cranberry Bog, The Swamp Buck, Ghost Camps of the North, and Wild Rice. Paul Arrington's The Red God's Call is a book almost everyone can relate to. You accompany Arrington in his formative years as he hunts, traps, and explores his boyhood home in eastern South Dakota. It could be subtitled Neat Things I Did as a Kid. He also colorfully describes battling the wits of a wily coyote. If historical ecology and observations on nature is up your alley or prairie trail, consider early journals such as those of Lewis and Clark. Also, those of Joseph Nicollet on the Plains and the Prairie, the expeditions of 1838 and 9 with journals, letters, and notes on the Dakota Indians, edited by Edmund Bray and Martha Coleman Bray from 1976. It includes, for example, Nicollet's description of their trepidations of traveling for several days between the James and the Cheyenne Rivers while surrounded by herds of bison. There are many other good books, of course, but if you're so inclined, find at least one good book about nature and read it this winter. I've listed a few of the other books along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with the founder of the Next Step ND about sex trafficking in North Dakota. After the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The head of the Lignite Energy Council says while he's disappointed in a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission ruling concerning coal-fired power, the door is not yet closed. The Federal Department of Energy asked FERC, or FERC, to look at how baseload power plants are compensated as part of the power grid for providing that power. But FERC said it didn't want to make a change.
It means more of the same.
Lignite Energy Council Executive Director Jason Bohr says that means North Dakota's lignite plants will continue to produce electricity at somewhat of a disadvantage, and that power grid operators don't compensate for everything the plants bring to the table.
You know, it would be equivalent to if Apple and Samsung were each selling phones, one of them had a 10-hour battery life and one of them had a 20-hour battery life, but you weren't able to charge more for the 20-hour battery life. That's kind of the situation we have with power.
Boris says FERC has left the door open for DOE and Congress to get involved. A task force made up of Trump administration cabinet members released its recommendations for how to help restore the rural economy. As Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach explains, the long-touted solution of expanding broadband is at the top of the list.
The task force's report says that in 2014, about 61% of rural residents had access to high-speed internet, compared to 96% of people in cities. The report suggests that closing that gap will help address other priorities, such as expanding distance learning, aiding in job training, accessing healthcare, building smart electrical grids, and using precision farming techniques. Already, the federal government provides funding to internet providers to expand their rural networks. The report didn't call for more money, but instead suggests that federal agencies streamline regulations. Other suggestions in the report to revive rural areas include expanding trade, improving services for veterans, and rebuilding roads and small-town water systems. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And the flu continues to circulate widely in North Dakota. Jill Baber is influenza surveillance coordinator at the North Dakota Department of Health. She says patients across the state continue to test positive for the flu.
Right now we have about 1,445 lab confirmed cases in the state that have been reported to us. However, some of the way that influenza testing has been done has kind of changed. So I actually think that compared with other seasons, we would be seeing much more if that hadn't happened. And so it's looking like it's going to be a fairly bad season this season.
Baber says it's not yet known exactly how effective this year's flu vaccine is, but she says more information will be available on that next month.
There's a lot of people talking about 10% because that was the efficacy for the flu vaccine in Australia. And we had the same strains in our flu vaccine as they did. So some people jumped to the conclusion that it would be the same. That's not necessarily true. It's too soon to tell. The CDC thinks it'll be closer to our efficacy last year, which was 35%. But again, we'll just have to see where it is. I'm hoping it's more than 10%. But even if it is just 10%, the influenza vaccine does help you, does help prevent like more severe illness. So even if you do get sick, you're less likely to be hospitalized. You're less likely to die. You're going to miss less work.
Baber says as long as influenza is circulating, it's never too late to get a flu shot. She says flu shots are available at pharmacies, your healthcare provider, and at local public health units. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Lisa Hansen. She is the founder of The Next Step ND, and she works in family ministry at Atonement Lutheran Church in Fargo. And she's joined us to talk about sex trafficking and the work she has done with this issue. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with human trafficking first. How do we define that process?
So it's really people being forced to do things that they wouldn't do by force, fraud, or coercion. So they don't have a choice in the matter. So a lot of the traffickers, yeah, so there's labor trafficking and then there's the sex trafficking industry. The sex trafficking by far is bigger, but we know there's labor trafficking. There's labor trafficking here in North Dakota. So,
how would you characterize the problem of human trafficking in the state, and why did you start this group in Fargo? I mean, you're from Fargo, Moorhead.
Correct.
But what's the severity of the problem here?
So in Fargo, we actually did help somebody actually with labor trafficked. I got a referral for a man that was being trafficked on a farm. He answered the ad, and he was labor trafficked. So it does labor trafficking does happen here. Primarily, it really is sex trafficking, especially in the western state with the oil fields, where there's a big demand and lots of money. There's a demand, and then there's a supply for trafficking.
But a year ago, I read an article where you were interviewed, and you said that the problem of sex trafficking in Fargo-Moorhead is actually greater than in western North Dakota.
Right now, I believe it is. Back then, when the oil industry was booming more, it was more prominent there. It was a small town. It was booming more. But on a whole, just in 2016, on Backpage.com, where they sell women and children for sex, there were 72,000 ads posted on Backpage alone just in North Dakota in 2016. So it's thriving here and it's growing here. So we know this is an issue.
What drew you to this work?
So I work in family ministry at Atoma Church, and during that time, I had a lady come and speak about trafficking and the work that she did in safe houses with women, and I saw the pictures that she showed of girls being trafficked, and from then on, I started educating myself and found out that it's not a global problem. It's not just in the United States. It's actually here in Fargo, and so I just started educating myself on the issue and knew that we have a problem here in Fargo, and the first thing that I had to do, I started Voice for the Captives, and that's the ministry here in Fargo that fights sex trafficking primarily. But there was an awareness issue. I can't fight something that people don't understand and don't know about. So I had to do a lot of awareness and speaking engagements just so people understood what sex trafficking looked like here in Fargo. So
what did you hope to do with the next step ND, which is now in its third year?
Right. So a couple years ago, I was hearing different stories from survivors, and I heard the obstacles that they have to go through to try to get back on their feet after they've been being sex trafficked. And a lot of them don't have education. They have records, felonies on their record. They have skills they don't have. They have children to feed. So coming out of trafficking, they go through treatment and counseling. And there's just no services. There's a gap in our community that we need to bridge to help them get back on their feet financially. So that's where I came in and started the survivor care program, the Next Step ND.
Well, describe that to us. What kind of help does the Next Step ND actually provide
here? Right. So the requests we get are from our navigator here in Fargo or from the shelters. They'll contact me. So they're tried and true trafficking victims. I step in when they're trying to get them out of the shelters and back on their feet. So we help them from anything from rent, utilities, medical bills, daycare costs, baby needs, food, clothing, vehicle repairs, bus passes, transportation. I mean, you name it, I've gotten called for it. So it's typically a financial need, but we also like to help with the relationship building in the community. So,
and you've got a fundraiser coming up on Friday, Purses for a Purpose. It's the Friday evening from 7 to 8:30 at Atonement Lutheran Church, which is in South Fargo, 4601 South University Drive in Fargo. What happens at Purses for a Purpose?
Yep. So the community come. This is open from 7 to 8:30. People can bring a new or a like new purse. And these are going to be going to, we're going to fill them kind of like blessing bags. So I have a list on our website of things that people can bring as well. And these purses are going to be given out to shelters and treatment centers and to first responders in Fargo and in North Dakota to give to girls and women and teen girls. When they rescue them, it'll be one of the first things these girls get handed is a purse with contents in there that they normally don't get in a shelter. It'll also have a wooden cross with a message of hope and scripture tied to it so they know we're here to care for them and so they know about our organization.
Is this how you're funded, these kinds of events, or where does the money stream come?
Yep, I don't have monthly donors. I go strictly on people doing events and fundraisers, and people donate that way, and that's how I get funded.
Oh, why purses? I think you mentioned you filled them, so they hold stuff,
right.
Obviously.
Actually, so I did some blessing bags a long time ago, and we just thought, you know, like there's some agencies that will give out like a teddy bear when they rescue a child or a backpack to children when they come in, and we just thought a way – what would resonate with girls or teen girls coming in? And we just thought, I was listening to a survivor and she thought, you know, let's do purses. It's something that all the girls like, or maybe it's a small backpack. And so that's why we started with Purses for a Purpose.
So if people want to donate a purse, they can bring a new one or one that looks pretty new, I hope.
Right. Yeah, I'm kind of picky. I want it to look nice because this is something that their girls are receiving, that they've been used. And I want the purses to feel like it's a new start and it's something that's really nice and it's a gift for them. So
again, it's Purses for a Purpose. It's Friday evening at 7 to 8:30 at Atonement Lutheran Church in South Fargo. And if people can't go, they can still help, right?
Absolutely. They can go to our website and they can donate on there online. And you can just email me if you want to get involved and want to volunteer at other events that we may be coming up. You can start a prayer group. I like to be covered in prayer in this work. So they can just contact us through the email.
Do you have a monetary goal?
We don't. This is the first year we've done an outreach in the community for the community to really step in and help out. We were hoping to raise or just to get like 100 purses, and we also have a silent auction to raise funds for this. We have a match of $2,500, so we're hoping to match that and even go over that. So right now we've collected, without the event even happening yet, we have probably over 300 purses that people have just brought in. So the sky's the limit. I don't know.
Well, 300 purses, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people, it is. And we've serviced in North Dakota last year, 100 people for sure.
Wow.
Here in North Dakota. So we don't know. We wish there wasn't a need, but I think this is growing, and I get more calls for care for these girls. So,
in my discussion with you before we went on the air, I discovered that Fargo has a human trafficking navigator who works out of YouthWorks.
Correct. Yep.
And you referenced this person before. So how does this all work? How does everybody stay connected?
Yeah, and that's her job. You know, she's the navigator. So really all the trafficking, human trafficking, she works with law enforcement, you know, with cases that are being tried. She works with people like me, just the smaller community that's, you know, working to fight trafficking. So she just connects us all. And, you know, this is a community effort. So that's kind of her job there.
You've been reported as saying that places like businesses like truck stops and strip joints sort of have, I guess, an assemblage of potential clients, I guess, if you will. And that's where this activity can be occasionally seen.
Correct.
Are these people who run these businesses enabling this?
I don't know if it's so much certain businesses. There is Truckers Against Trafficking. I mean, we know with two interstates going through here, the truck stops are a hot spot, and the truckers just simply call ahead and say where they have the girl at, and the truckers go there, and the girl's forced to go cab to cab to cab to cab. So that's an issue because we have a lot of truck stops with our two interstates. I don't know how much coercion and is going on that's corrupt with businesses. We do know that a lot of the times hotels are in on it because, I mean, this is a huge industry. This is a $32 billion a year industry globally. So there's just corruption and like the police departments, the hotels, a lot of times it just depends on where you're at and what city to help this thrive where it's at. So it's tricky. It's harder to say who's doing what, but.
Well, you mentioned 72,000 ads posted on Backpage selling women and kids in North Dakota, just in the state of North Dakota. So that's an awful lot of activity. And you have in the past said that there's a correlation between sex trafficking or human trafficking and drug trafficking.
Right. So I think the drug traffickers, it used to be seen as the number one organized crime. And I think the sex trafficking, I've heard from others, I agree that it's quickly, if it's not the number one organized crime now, because the drug traffickers are smarter. You know, you can only sell drugs once. It's a one deal. And so they're smartening up by using humans and particularly sex trafficking because they can use them over and over and over again. So they're more profitable.
Let's talk a bit about the behavior that is involved in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, how does a pimp coerce or convince a young woman to become his prostitute?
You know, that's a good question. It's a grooming process. These traffickers, pimps, I mean, they're very, very clever. They know how to groom and control these girls. A lot of times once they've forced them to get to another place, they'll befriend them. Either they'll befriend them or they'll hire people to befriend girls through boyfriends or other girls. And once they get them to point B, a lot of times they're raped, it's videotaped, or they're forced to do things that they're not wanting to do. And they'll hold that over their head as a threat. They know where these girls live. They know their friends. They know about them. So it's very easy, honestly, to control these girls. Even if they have a cell phone, they feel like they have no way out. They have no choice. So that's a stigma we need to really erase from people, that these girls are forced to do this.
So there is a control issue here, control issue.
Right.
So how are those pimps and johns created?
So honestly, this is a cultural issue. I believe our culture is so highly sexualized that traffickers thank our culture for doing a lot of the grooming for them, because once you get these girls, just our culture, the things that people see on social media, we're just becoming desensitized to movies and things in nature. If we would have seen a lot of things years ago that we see now, I think we would have been traumatized. And now it's just like nothing to people. And the boys, pornography is a huge issue, not just for men, but for women. And age 8 is the average age that boys start looking at pornography, and that's the stepping stone to trafficking women.
We have had this watershed event happen across this country and maybe around the world, and that is the sexual harassment outing, if you will, mm-hmm. of bad men in positions of power and the Me Too movement. And mm-hmm. Is there a trickle down here? Do young girls and women who might feel that they've been victimized this way maybe feel freer to pick up that cell phone and say, I am being trafficked?
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I hope that's a movement that they can get the courage to stand up to their trafficker and try to get out. They fear for their lives. So it's a little bit different with these girls because they have somebody over them threatening their lives and the lives of their family. So it's a little tougher, but it is, absolutely. So I'm hoping that this maybe empowers them to step up and try to get help. But there's a human trafficking hotline for them to call as well that they can try to help get out. So, yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah, but there is help if they look for it.
There is help. Yep, the trafficking hotline, if they can get to a phone, we have it on our website. And, they'll go right to the police and they'll try to come and get them. A lot of girls, it's tough to even prosecute them because they're afraid to go against a trafficker. And because the trafficker knows, even though I'm in jail, I want you to know I still control you from the jail cell because they have people working for them outside.
And they'll get out.
And they will. And so the girls feel, they fear for their life all the time. So...
Well, after your experience with Voices for the Captives, mm-hmm. 5 years ago you started that, and a couple of years ago you started the Next Step ND. Do you have any recommendations for policymakers, the people writing laws in the state, and considering how to deal with this problem?
Boy, the biggest thing is we really need to we need to deter the Johns. And so by doing so, it's like we really need to expose them. And, sometimes I've seen in the media that they'll hide the names of the Johns, the people that are actually, doing the victimizing. And we need to start exposing these names. And I don't care who they are. I don't care if they're a politician. I don't care if they're the president. I don't care what line of work they are. We need to be exposing the ones that when they do these things and they arrest them and not the victims. And I've seen that a few years ago, they flip-flopped that and they were exposing the victims and throwing their name in the paper. And it's the Johns we need to expose. That is really the key. For the demand to dry up because they're afraid to be caught.
Well, what's our responsibility? I mean, we're going to businesses. We see people in large groups. Maybe we see something that looks a little odd to us. I mean, mm-hmm. what should we be looking for?
Right. There's just no really good answer to that. A lot of times I will see older men. I will see men. The girls look really sheepish. They won't look at you or give you eye contact. If something doesn't look right with the guy, it probably isn't. A lot of people think, well, she has a phone so she could get out of it. So clearly she's not being trafficked. That's not true. So really report it. We have to be the eyes and ears for these girls because they're hoping someone recognizes that they're in a situation they're trying to get out of and they can't. But you can see the control and the power. These guys will buy them a lot of lavish. They will lavish them with clothes and money so they'll look good. So it's hard to spot, but
they'll
be isolated. The parents can see how their children are being isolated from their friends and they'll come home with nice things. And those are really big factors.
Well, it takes a village, and the village can help by assembling an atonement for Purses for a Purpose.
Absolutely.
This Friday at 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And again, they're looking for purses, personal items, giving to the silent auction, making a monetary gift, and just showing up and showing support, right?
Correct, yep.
Lisa Hansen, thank you for spending some time with our listeners today.
Thank you.
Coming up next, refugees to Canada.
Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so, we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Time is running out for hundreds of thousands of immigrants to the U.S. who hold what's called temporary protected status. Last fall, the deadline was announced for almost 60,000 Haitians who were allowed into the U.S. after devastating hurricanes. And 200,000 people from El Salvador have been ordered to leave the U.S. starting in March. As a result, an unprecedented number of asylum seekers have walked across the northern border into Canada, which historically welcomes refugees. NPR's Lauren Madelon reports.
Here's a recent bulletin from Canada's National Public Network, the CBC.
Canada is bracing for a possible new wave of asylum seekers.
Among the new arrivals is Agathe Saint-Preux, a Haitian. I met her as she shared lunch with other Haitians at a cafe. She says she lived in Miami for 12 years, but last summer, as signs signaled the end of a temporary U.S. residency program for Haitians, Saint-Preux crossed into Canada illegally and made her way to Montreal.
It's like I breathe better. Life is quiet here and people are kind.
Canada has historically valued the skills and money that many migrants bring in. But Canada's refugee systems become overloaded since the election of President Donald Trump.
We've got a backlog today of maybe 30,000 claims, whereas about 2 years ago, the backlog was maybe 10 or 15,000.
That's David Berger, an immigration lawyer and former member of Canada's parliament. New arrivals are supposed to get an immigration hearing within 60 days. That isn't happening. Berger says there aren't enough immigration judges, known in Canada as decision makers.
We believe the government has to appoint more decision makers. 120 decision makers is just not enough.
One national poll suggests 4 in 10 Canadians believe the country is taking in too many refugees. Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has been criticized for a tweet he sent out last January saying, "To those fleeing persecution, terror, and war, Canadians will welcome you." Trudeau says immigrants benefit Canada culturally and economically.
That being welcoming and open is a source of strength.
In 2017, Canada took in 43,500 refugees, many who arrived by walking illegally into Canada. That number will rise to more than 50,000 by 2020, part of what Canada's ruling Liberal Party calls the most ambitious immigration levels in recent history. The fate of refugees has also complicated the Canada-U.S. diplomatic relationship at times. Trudeau's tweet was sent out the same day the Trump administration moved to ban travelers from 7 majority Muslim nations. Marjorie Villefranche heads Maison d'Haïti, Haiti House, a resource center for refugees.
I think that the tension is, how can a country like Canada, you know, admit that the United States is not a safe country? Politically, it's very difficult to, you know, to say that.
Canada does a lot to at least help refugees get started, even before a final decision on whether or not they can stay permanently. When refugees arrive, they get a monthly stipend, around $650. Their children can go to school, and like all Canadians, they get health care. Philip Oxhorn's a political scientist at McGill University.
There's undoubtedly overcrowding, but the state has done as much as one might expect given the huge relative increase in the numbers of people coming.
Oxhorn says Canada is wrestling with those numbers. But given the government's plan to increase immigration levels, he expects the country will continue to value the place that refugees hold in Canada's multi-ethnic tapestry. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Madelon in Montreal.
That report originally aired during Monday's morning edition. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. We all love jokes, but do we need them? We want to laugh, but is laughing itself important or just a distraction from the heavier, more meaningful aspects of life? On the next Why, we'll ask these questions and see, hopefully, that philosophy can be serious and funny at the same time. Join me and Al Jinny for Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives on Why Radio, Sunday, January 14th at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
If you
you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question, it's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via Facebook, where we are Main Street at Prairie Public. And you can still call toll-free 888-755-6377.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 9th. On September 8th, 1897, the Presentation Sisters opened St. John's Orphanage and Free School in Fargo. The building used to house St. Joseph's Convent and Academy, but the convent shifted that year to the Sacred Heart Academy, making room for the new orphan school. The school held strong for almost 10 years until it was destroyed in a fire on January 19th, 1907. The sisters moved the children to the basement of St. Mary's Cathedral, with their classes held at the Sacred Heart Academy. The Hancock brothers of Fargo got to work on designing a new building at the old site. J.H. Powers constructed it, and by Christmas of that year, a new building that could hold up to 100 students stood at 808 7th Avenue North. It took $40,000 to build, or the equivalent of over $900,000 now. On this date in 1908, the new St. John's Orphanage and Free School held a public reception and opened its doors for 87 children. Throughout the 1930s, the number of students at St. John's steadily shrank. By the 1940s, there were only 60 children. This trend may seem like a good thing, but what the sisters noticed is that while the number of actual orphans declined, they were housing a larger number of emotionally disturbed children. In 1958, the Fargo Fire Marshal said that St. John's license should not be renewed until a new and safer facility was constructed. The sisters took this as an opportunity to create a more modern facility that could help both orphans and emotionally troubled children. They created Villa Nazareth in 1961, signaling the end of St. John's. This organization continues to help people in the Fargo-Moorhead area. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
The Winter Olympics come next month, including the sport of skeleton. When you hurdle face first on a narrow sled, your chin just an inch or two above the ice.
It is the perfect combination of meathead and freestyle zen athlete.
What kind of crazy does it take to do this sport? We find out on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, we'll talk about the millions of people who are unable to control their eating with Dr. Joan Ifland. She calls it a food addiction, with a cycle of craving, overeating, remorse, and self-loathing. She'll join us to discuss the problem and offer tips to break the food addiction cycle. And we'll share an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast with Corey Steiner, superintendent of schools at Northern Cass, about customized learning. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.